from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of the upcoming season at Clues Memorial Hall.
I'll learn about the Myths of Addiction show at the Harrison Center.
And I'll chat with the Indianapolis Arts Center's new director, Carter Wolf. And of course, we'll have our Arts Calendar we call
What'll We Do? All this and more right after the latest news from NPR. Though the auditorium was built more than four decades ago, Clues Memorial Hall keeps its programming of the moment, as Sharon Gamble found out recently when she invited Clues Community Relations Manager James Kramer to tell us about their 2009-2010 season.
So once again, you've managed to program a really broad season, and you're starting off with somebody very high profile.
Yes, indeed. Joshua Redman will be kicking off our Clues Presents season on Saturday, September 19th. And it's an 8 o'clock show. He has just been a wonderful force in the jazz idiom. And to be able to bring him into Indy and to really get to experience an evening at Clues with him is just going to be, I think, a wonderful, wonderful way to experience jazz. And maybe a different setting than what people may normally do around town.
And you actually debuted him to Indianapolis back in the mid-90s, right?
You know, you're right. It has just been a wonderful ride, you know, to have artists who maybe at a certain point in their career, to bring them in, to introduce them or maybe reintroduce them. And then certainly when we have that opportunity to bring them back, and we'll be talking about another comeback, if you will, mm-hmm. kid, later on in our talk. It's great to have him back, though.
And he's followed by the splendor and the visual drama of Ballet Hispanico.
Yes, indeed. Their founder and artistic director, Tina Ramirez, has just retired, and so they have a new director and out taking this company out on tour and really working within the community. They're going to be here for a few days, so we'll be able to do some community outreach activities with them as well as the performance.
Working with school kids?
That as well as the general public.
Cool.
You know, it's one of those perks to being a subscriber, to get invited to some things that might be going on with the company, whether it's dance lessons or watching a master class with pre-professional students, a variety of things that we can do to really make the company stay in town, a part of the community, not just come in for the performance and then leave right afterward.
Yeah.
It's really a wonderful way to engage them, and I think for people to get a greater and deeper understanding and connection. And they're going to be here on Saturday, October 10th. So I encourage people to be kind of looking for various ways to get a little deeper and a little more connected into what's going on in their whole time here.
That's mm-hmm. intriguing and exciting. Mm-hmm. And then you turn a big corner with a country legend.
Yes.
Someone who has who's known for not only his artistry but the twinkle in his eye.
Yes, yes. Clint Black is going to be on our stage in November, on Friday, November 6th. And I think that, you know, people may be familiar with his music. They may be familiar with his appearance on Celebrity Apprentice this season.
Don't hold that against him.
People may know him. But it's interesting. You know, when we book the acts in, in advance, and then when they are actually in preparation for and we're building up publicity for, to find out where else they're involved in art. Not just maybe in their medium, but in a variety of other ways of getting out there and being the entertainer. And I think that's wonderful to know that more than a country and western singer, actor, performer, mm-hmm. you know, all around showman. So I think that's going to be a wonderful, wonderful performance for people to come and, again, to engage in and feel like they're, you know, part of that experience. It's
yeah.
not just a silent observer. They're actually going to be able to be, you know, engaged in this performance in a much deeper way.
There was a time a couple of decades ago when it would be unusual to have what used to be called a country and western singer on the Clues stage. But we were talking before we turned on the microphones about how mainstream country music has become.
Well, that, and I think that we have a unique opportunity and then responsibility to the community to bring in some artists and some art forms that may not be expected at Clues, that keeps people always guessing, maybe, and engaged. What are they going to present this time? What, knowing that the quality is there, but knowing exactly how that, is that going to play out? And, you know, clearly, if you've had an artist who's been performing in arenas, bringing it to a 2,200-seat auditorium setting, it's going to have a little different feel to it. And I think that's a wonderful way to experience an artist in a different way than maybe you have been introduced to them, or maybe you've seen them before, or if you've never seen them, what a great way to start.
Absolutely.
And yes.
Very elegant setting. Mm. An elegant setting and Groovaloo don't necessarily call out to one another across a crowded cocktail room.
No, not at all. I mean, as we were saying
what
earlier.
What is a Groovaloo?
Groovaloo,
we should start with.
Okay, Groovaloos are, and Groovaloo is the name of the show, and Groovaloos are the performers. They're breakdancers. And within the context of this show, more than us just taking all of our patrons out to the curb and seeing this dance go on in the streets is where it originally started. We've actually brought it to the stage, and they have a staged version of dance as well as story. They will tell their stories. It's based in their experiences of what has drawn them to street dance, what keeps them engaged, how has this become their art form of expression. And I think that's really exciting because it really broadens all of our horizons for what art is. You know, when I first heard about it, I thought, well, breakdance, that's just so, I mean, how is that an art form? And how is that
work
on a stage?
How does that work on a big stage? Yeah.
Well, what I've seen of clips and in seeing them now, again, because they were on Superstars of Dance this year, after we'd booked them in, we saw them on TV, and it was like, this is great to really express a movement type medium in discussion. It's tough to talk about dance. You have to see dance. You have to experience dance. And so this is a wonderful way for that to be combined. You know, so we're not just coming in and seeing people spin on their heads, although that is part of the show.
Yeah.
It's more than that. It's, well, why is that so important to you? And what is, you know, if someone is talking about their family and needing to keep up the sort of family image and not disappointing and, you know, their father and his desires for where they were going to go and how they were going to be successful as a young professional. And they're not feeling that to be called to be a doctor.
Yeah.
What they're really wanting to do is move and be an artist and move in this way. I think that's a wonderful lesson for all of us to really follow our heart and follow our passion and be successful at it.
You described it a little bit, again, before we turned on the microphones, a little bit like a chorus line where the individuals are stepping forward and telling their stories, and yet they're still part of this collective.
Exactly. It's that and a little bit of deaf poetry jam. So you've got some of the hip-hop and rap that's going on along with this. So it all combines together to create its own unique show, I think unlike anything anyone has seen.
Will there be any chance to work with kids, with school kids?
You know, we hope to, because I think it seems like such a logical fit. And
absolutely,
so many groups that are out now are wanting to share that. It's not just, you know, part of their educational outreach mission. There really is a love and a serious desire for not only carrying on and passing that on, but to share what you're passionate about with other people who have the youth that we're always encountering have such a genuine love for learning. And I think when you can reach into that and you're not maybe jaded by years of having to learn, that your love is really there and you're really passionate about new things and exploring new ways to move, new ways to speak or sing or act, It's such a wonderful way for us to reach out and fill that desire and fill that need for some people.
Mm-hmm. And then we turn a corner again as we get into February. And if you say banjo to the next 10 people who walk by, they'll probably think Bela Fleck. And there's a new project called the Africa Project.
Yes,
what's that about?
Well, it is exploring the roots. You know, so often we think, and I, you know, was right there along with everyone else, that we think of banjo as being this a sort of a southern period type of instrument.
Yeah.
You know, we think of Old Susanna, we think of
Civil War songs,
a variety of things. And
yeah,
certainly those are there. But where did that come from? How did it come to America to begin with? Well, Bela went back to Africa, discovered the roots of, connected with various artists who really were working with and still creating these instruments that are the origins of the banjo. So now has collaborated with them, is out touring with them, so bringing their experience and their history to the rest of the world. Again, it's a wonderful, entertaining evening, but as of all of our programs, there's some educational component there.
Shh, don't tell. We're sneaking it in.
I know.
And then one of the preeminent chamber-sized orchestras of the world, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, that has been performing for something like, is it four decades? Five decades now. Yikes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it, time passes quickly. And I think they have, in a relatively in history, short period of time, established themselves as this group that is just name recognition. You know, I think that anyone who is familiar with recordings, with listening to anything on air here, has heard Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. And it's going to be, again, a wonderful way to cap off our season. We close that October 10th. That's a Saturday night, again, 8 o'clock. And, April 10th. Thank you. And it is just a wonderful way to culminate this fabulous variety of season offerings that we have. You know, and people oftentimes like to subscribe, get that entire package because of the variety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, others may say, you know, I really want to focus in on this one. But, you know, if you're buying that season subscription, you can change tickets within the series and, you know, come to see a show with your friends, introduce them to the things that you're interested in. And what a wonderful way to share and build a community of you know, fellow arts lovers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, along with that, we have a variety of things that go on around those performances. We open the door at 6:30 for an 8 o'clock show. People can come in, enjoy music. We have live music playing in the lobby. It creates a wonderful atmosphere. They can purchase refreshments, enjoy a pre-performance discussion with local experts in the field who will be talking about the art form or the artist or maybe local offerings. That, you know, what I think about is great about that is people come, enjoy this experience, and know that that artist may only be here for a day or two. There is a local connection that goes far beyond that, precedes it, and goes on well past their appearance here. And when you've connected with that and maybe been introduced to something that you didn't even realize we had a great local presence of, now you can become a patron of local artists as well. And I think it just really builds and strengthens all of our community, artists as well as arts patrons, and then, of course, at a national, international level for awareness. And it just really is a wonderful way to just bring it all together,
sure.
You know, into community.
Very grassroots,
center.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are you doing any visual arts exhibits this year?
We do. So it's more, Clues is more than a performing arts facility now. It is a performing and visual arts facility. We have a rotating exhibition of local artists, Hoosier artists, that will be in for maybe 6 to 8 weeks at a time throughout the year. You know, that we have a variety of named artists and some up-and-coming artists, and it's a wonderful way for them to share with our patrons what they're doing, and it's a wonderful way for our patrons to, again, learn that there's more than just a watercolor or an acrylic or a landscape, that art is very broad in its definition and in its offerings here. And it's wonderful because certainly not every one of the exhibitions we have in appeals to every person, but you hope that in the variety of things that we show, that people are feeling enjoyment and some sort of connection to, and come away from it again with a broader understanding of what we have in the way of local talent, what the, again, that definition of art can be. It's much broader than I've ever thought it was, and it's been a wonderful experience to be able to coordinate those artists locally.
Now, you've been at Clues for several years now. How many is it?
Oh, we're not counting. I've kind of lost count. I've been there since I was there in school at Butler.
Yeah.
And so it's 30 years, you know, and counting. But in a full-time capacity for about 5 years, 5 or 6 years now. And it's in community relations now for these past 3 years, starting into my fourth year as being able to bring the word out to the community. And it's just a wonderful opportunity to share the things that I'm passionate about and that, you know, that other people may get passionate about if they hear about and
sure.
are introduced to.
It's hard to imagine that there's somebody listening to this who has never been to Clues Hall, but if there is, tell me something sort of magical
you, about
that,
it.
That people who haven't been should know.
I think we've touched on it a little bit. It's grand. It's a grand auditorium. It's a grand lobby space. The structure is very just a wonderful space. It really is. It's very contemporary, but it has a feeling of just uplifting when you walk into the space. You know, you visually, your eye goes up 60 feet into this grand lobby space, and then mirrors that when you go into the auditorium and see the soaring clouds above. But within that, there's a feeling of intimacy because the acoustics are so fine that wherever you are in that auditorium, if you're 100 feet from the stage, when you're listening to a solo performer on stage, it's as if they're right next to you because the acoustics just surround each individual in there. And I think that's a wonderful combination of feeling spacious, roomy, comfortable seating, and yet feeling that you're very close to the performance and being able to share that with a couple thousand other people who are there enjoying the very same thing you are. And what a wonderful way, again, to build that community that says, I'm not alone out here and I'm not the only person who likes this. So you're going to expect to find, even though we have ample parking around, that sometimes some of these acts will sell out the hall, and we encourage people to get there early and enjoy all of the evening that they can when they come to the hall.
Sharon Gamble with James Kramer, Community Relations Manager of Clues Memorial Hall, on the campus of Butler University. Check out the 09-10 season and other Clues events at cluesHall.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. This September at the Harrison Center will be the first of its kind gallery event designed to educate the general public about the myths of addiction. The exhibit is also a celebration of the Emberwood Center, which has provided addiction services and counseling for 30 years in Indianapolis. Travis DiNicola spoke with Emberwood's president, Vince Fela, and the Harrison Center's Joanna Taft about the exhibit.
Vince, I'd like to start with asking you to tell me a bit more about Emberwood, which is certainly organizing the exhibit Myths and Fairy Tales of Addiction. But Emberwood's actually a new name for an organization that's been around for, what, 30 years now?
30 years now, yeah. Emberwood used to be Community Addiction Services of Indiana, and we've gone through a capacity building and rebranding process the past couple of years and came up with the new name Emberwood. We're located on the Near East Side and have been since we started back in 1979.
You're in that sort of big and kind of bluish industrial building just a little bit off of Mass Avenue and 10th Street.
Right.
And what does Emberwood mean to you? I mean, how did that name come up? I mean, before, you know, you had addiction in your name. I know you provide services for people who do have different addictions. But where does the Emberwood name come from?
Well, part of it is trying to re-describe some of what we do. When we talk about addictions, that's a very harsh, hard word. And hopefully the staff, when they come in, they're much more welcoming and caring and so forth. But the idea of Emberwood is kind of two pieces. Ember being that small coal that gives birth to the fire, to the flame, to the change and everything. And a lot of times the people that come through our doors, that ember is very, very dull and almost ready to go out. And our job is to kind of rekindle that spark to get them looking at themselves and changing and going forward.
Tell me more about your clients, the people who come into your center.
Well, we work with young people in the treatment component as young as 11 years old.
Wow.
And we work up to adults age 75. We have separate programs for them. We also do a prevention program, which we actually teach Taekwondo as an alternative activity.
Now, this is not a center where people, it's not like a rehab retox or a detox center where people come in and live, correct?
No, this is considered an outpatient program, so people will come in anywhere from 1 to 3 times a week, depending upon the level of care they're involved in.
Mm-hmm. And how do they find out about your program?
Well, a lot of our clients, the majority, are either court-ordered or ordered by probation or the Department of Child Services to address issues that brought them to the attention of the courts. And usually the underlying problem is some alcohol or drug abuse.
And it is primarily alcohol and drug abuse. And I don't mean to be flip here, but when you say addiction, I mean some people could be, you know, addicted to video games or addicted to shopping or chocolate even, I suppose. But you know, that's not the type of addictions you
Want. We're focusing on the substance use disorders, and we also do provide some gambling addiction treatment.
Okay. And do you see a lot of a crossover if people are have an addictive personality, they're addicted to one thing, they're addicted to other things as well?
Well, there's not a lot of evidence to support the idea of the addictive personality anymore.
Okay.
But there is a lot of people who have a behavioral pattern that they will use things. Now, it's unusual for somebody who might be abusing stimulants to want to use depressants at the same time because you're going in different directions. Some people who use narcotics, which is a major painkiller, they're looking to kill that very harsh emotional pain they're experiencing. And they're less likely to, say, use some kind of hallucinogenic drug, which would intensify that pain.
Now, that's interesting, the idea that sort of the myth, I suppose, if you will, of the addictive personality is such, as well as many other myths. And that's really part of what this show that that you're having at the Harrison is all about, is sort of explaining these myths, dispelling them. One thing that I know that, Vince, that that Emerald really emphasizes is that addiction is a disease, correct?
Yes, that is very much a disease. And one of the real myths is that it's some kind of a moral weakness or something. And a lot of times all of these myths come together and it actually keeps people from accessing the services they need to deal effectively with the substance use disorders.
Explain that a little bit more, because that I think that's an important thing for people to understand, that by understanding addiction as a disease as opposed to some sort of moral deficiency. I mean, how does that affects behavior?
Right. Think of substance use disorders as basically chronic progressive diseases, diabetes, cancer, heart disease. If it goes untreated, it progressively gets worse and potentially could end in the end of life. So the idea is when somebody looks at it, say, as that moral weakness or a willpower issue, they'll say, well, if I just try harder, I could do it. When we're really dealing with physiological and neurological issues that require a lot of attention.
Now, where did the idea come from to explore and dispel these myths through an art exhibit?
Well, we were looking at lots of different ways to kind of build awareness and kind of deal with some of those the stigma related to getting help, and the myths tied into it. So one of our board members, who is an artist, said, well, why don't we look at an art show?
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of evolved as we brought more people in. We refined the ideas more and then thought, okay, this is really an ideal venue because it goes beyond what I'll call our usual suspects. Whenever there's a meeting or an educational session that we have, it focuses on people who are already in the field or who have had experience. We're looking to reach out to others, family members and people, to dispel those myths and hopefully encourage more people to access services.
And I want to be clear that the exhibit that's at the Harrison is not an exhibit of work created by your clients, correct?
No. The exhibit is very much an open exhibit. It's where I ask people to interpret addictions and recovery, whether they themselves are addicts or in recovery, may have grown up in a family, may have seen or witnessed something. So it's completely open, and a lot of different people will be sharing their interpretations and their ideas.
Great. Joanna Taft, let me bring you into the conversation here. As a director of the Harrison Center for the Arts, one of just the coolest art venues, I think, anywhere, each month you have a different show, a thematic show in your main gallery and your other galleries. Sometimes it's sort of fun and frivolous. Sometimes it involves a cause or another organization like this. Tell me a bit more.
We've learned that we've been very successful at creating public conversations at the Harrison Center. And artists often have things to say through their art, and often people want to wrestle with big issues through their art. And so the Harrison Center, this show was a great fit, because as we learned more about Emberwood, we realized that they were providing a really important service to the community. And all of us have deal with addictions, whether or not personally or friends or family. And so this issue hits home. We've had great response from artists wanting to be involved. The show in gallery number 2 will have 5 artists doing both installation art and paintings for the show. And then in the underground, Emberwood is organizing another exhibit, which is they've opened up the community. In fact, they've recruited some artists from Chicago to participate in the show, and it's going to be kind of silent auction style of
art. Oh, great.
And that will be in the underground. So throughout the building, you'll be exposed to myths in different ways. And, in fact, we've decided to name the entire open house Mythalanius, which was a little bit better maybe than misdiagnosis. We couldn't say, you know, we're trying to...
Tough words.
Right, that's right. So, anyway, we're really looking forward to it because, again, we've had good success with this type of event in the past, and it's always good to have a new partner and fresh material to work with.
Now, I'm very curious, Joanna, as far as how you approached the artists that you work with and what their response was. The Harrison Center, along with having different gallery spaces as well as performance space and community space, is also the home to many artists who have their studios there. And I know that for many of your exhibits, you go to those artists who have their studios there to ask them if they want to participate. So how did you pitch something like this? Was it focused on the idea of myth or addiction? And the work that they're coming back with, I mean, the ideas that they're coming back with, you know, how does an artist interpret this without being too didactic?
Well, we actually started with the idea of addiction. We weren't sure what the title was going to be, and we started with the idea of addictions. And we actually have an artist we've worked with quite a bit, Elise Elder, who's an addictions counselor. And so we went to her first.
Well, isn't that convenient?
That's convenient, yeah. So we went to her with some ideas, and she immediately had a variety of installation ideas that she was quite passionate about creating. And so we pitched those to Emberwood, and they liked it. And so we started with her, and then we started thinking about other artists whose work would go well with Elise's work.
I see.
And then and then we pitched the idea of the theme to them. And surprisingly enough artists, again, this comes close to home for a lot of people because they have either their personal experiences or family experiences. And so we didn't have anybody say no.
So many artists have personal experiences that they could relate to.
Right,
Now, I know the show doesn't actually open until Friday, September 4th, for the Big Friday Gala Grand Opening. That's part of the First Friday events. Can you tell me a little bit more about, perhaps Elise's work, what she's doing in preparing for this?
Yeah, one of the pieces she's doing is a large installation called The Elephant in the Room. And so the whole idea is that there's nothing to see, the people don't feel, they don't speak, they don't ask, they don't tell, and so her piece is communicating that. She does a really good job of writing up some of our artists struggle with putting into words what their pieces mean.
Sure.
Elise is very good at that, so we're really excited about the material that she's preparing for the show to help interpret her work, and she'll have a number of installations.
Oh, that's excellent. So she'll have, so there's both the visual element that you're experiencing as well as the information that she's providing.
Right. But we have other artists as well. Kip Norman, who's a well-known installation artist, is also doing a piece, and his story, the way that he tells stories through found objects and taking broken things and old things, and creating, you know, beauty, really is the story of Emberwood, too, when you think about that. People that come to them needing help and leave with that spark of that beauty. So we have installation artists. We also have painters. Mark Allen Miller, who's just amazing, has shown at the Harrison Center before. And a photographer, Austin Dixon, who has some great addiction stories. So we're really looking forward to telling this story visually and creating this public conversation, and we know that that it will be a great time for everyone.
Now, Joanna, I know that one thing you really try to do with Harrison Center openings is to create some sort of experience that is sticky, the word I've heard you use before, that in a sense that people can, you know, whether it's physically or metaphorically, sort of take with them afterwards. Can you give us a preview of the sticky moment?
Well, we're developing a performance piece called Cycles of Addiction. And I was driving downtown one day, and it was at night. It was like midnight. And under the interstate were these guys playing bicycle polo in the dark of night, you know? And I'm like, what on earth is going on? Well, I've recognized a couple of them, and they mm-hmm. were artists. And so we have been talking to them about developing. They all know people that are involved in, that have addiction issues. And so we're developing this performance piece for the gym. We're still working
bicycle
on...
Bicycle polo.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So we're still working on how we make it... it's kind of the diet version because it can be a brutal sport. So,
yeah.
You know, we're doing some fun, some pieces like that. And then Vince, who I've just been so impressed with his ideas, but you know, he has this game show that he's doing called Know Your Dope. And, and you know, they have all these great kind of interactive activities that will be around the building. And again, we'll also be roasting marshmallows and telling stories in the courtyard. Cool. I think everybody has
so
a little
So it sounds like you're having a lot of fun with it, too. I mean, even though it's a very serious issue, the exhibit itself is going to be quite enjoyable, it sounds like. Vince, I want to ask you, as we close this out, just to tell me about sort of your experience in making this leap into the art world. Obviously, you've been a part of the not-for-profit world for a long time, but more in the social services area, health services. This is sort of a different approach, I would imagine, for you.
Yeah, it is. I've always kidded people that I wanted to be a stand-up administrator, but my comic abilities are limited. Throughout the years, we've looked at lots of different ways to reach out to people,
mm-hmm.
and we haven't done as good a job generally as a field in doing that. And so we thought, let's look for other ways. The scare tactics don't work, the horror stories, the this is what happened to me. And turning to the arts
mm-hmm.
to give somebody something to look at, the mention of the elephant in the room, that's very metaphorical in the world of addiction services, in that nobody really talks about the drug abuser or mm-hmm. what's going on. They avoid that topic. So we thought, let's completely go out of our element and see if we can engage some others, artists, in actually providing another way to look at.
I would imagine there's been some surprises along the way for you, too.
Oh, there really has. I mean, it's just kind of snowballing with all the things. I've talked to several people. Because September is also Recovery Month nationally, and when they hear about some of the ideas, just sitting around with Joanna and some of the other people, the creative energies that flow and generate mm-hmm. and the what-ifs, you know, really coming together and blossoming.
Travis DiNicola with Joanna Taft from the Harrison Center for the Arts and Vince Fela from the Emberwood Center. The exhibit Myths and Fairy Tales of Addiction opens on Friday, September 4th. For more information about the Harrison, visit harrisoncenter.org. And for more information about Emberwood, visit indianaaddictions.org. Travis, we have to hurry.
Yes, Sharon? Why's that?
What? Summer is almost over.
It is just zipping past, isn't it?
I know. And we only have a brief time today to tell you about some arts events going on our calendar that we call
What Do We Do?
So talk fast.
It's
what
like
do you
the
got?
Express version.
That's right.
Well, the State Fair is still going on, and there's a lot of cool stuff, including tonight and tomorrow, whooping and hollering and ringing of cowbells, and it's all taking place at the Pioneer Village at their opera house. Actually, Saturday, August 15th, it's the National Barn Dance. And it's bringing together dozens of regional performers, and it's sort of like the Grand Old Opry, but here in Indiana. And it takes place both at 7 p.m. and 8 p.m. Saturday, August 15th, Pioneer Village Opera House. And you know, if you like old time music, like you know Gene Autry and you know the Hoosier Hot Shots are going to be there too. And Dick Wolfsey's even introducing the show. It'll be fun.
Oh, that is fun. Yeah. I have another highlight of the State Fair. You have to pronounce it the Indiana way, though. You can't call them llamas. They're llamas in the heartland
mm-hmm.
here. It's Leaping Llama and Llama Limbo at 8 a.m. Yes,
it's like Llama Yimbo.
Yeah, Llama Yimbo. It's worth getting up early for next Saturday, August 22nd. There are events that involve dressing up llamas as pirates and other things in the llama costume competition. And I am not making this up. You just need to get up early on Saturday the 22nd, get to the fairgrounds by 8 o'clock for Leaping Llama and Llama Limbo.
It's like My Little Pony, the Llama Edition.
Oh no, melted My Little Ponies.
The classic Ragtime Society of Indiana is next weekend presenting a weekend of early American music featuring all ragtime music. You can get lots more information at indianarag.org, but basically it takes place the 21st, 22nd, and 23rd, and they've got performers from all over the country who are coming in. There's a dinner, there's a seminar, there's a breakfast buffet, and most importantly, there's concerts taking place at the Ramada Inn Ballroom. Again, more information, indianarag.org.
But no dressed-up furry pack animals. Hey, you'll soon hear a conversation with the new executive director of the Indianapolis Arts Center, Carter Wolf. But I want to remind you that the Arts Center is kicking off its 75th anniversary year on Saturday, August 22nd, from 6:30 p.m. to 1 a.m. with their big summer fundraiser party. It's called Art Sparkle. This year, it's Art Sparkle Mardi Gras, and the featured musical act is Buckwheat Zydeco. So contact the
That's
Indianapolis Arts
show.
Center. Oh, amazing food and great entertainment and an opportunity to dress up.
There you go. Hey, this Thursday, the 20th, up at the Carmel Gazebo, the Indiana Wind Symphony is playing their season finale, their last concert of the year, and it's a free one. And so definitely worth checking out. 6:30 this Thursday up at the Carmel Gazebo, Indiana Wind Symphony.
Very good. Put this on your calendar now so you don't forget about it. On August 29th from noon to 3:30 at the Indiana State Library and Historical Building, it's WOW, Words on Wings, Indiana Poets, featuring Indiana Poet Laureate Norbert Croft, who has a new book you'll hear about in an upcoming Art of the Matter. That's coming up on Saturday, August 29th, noon to 3:30, and it is free. We like free.
We like free. Very good. Well, we will be back next week with more free and not-so-free things to do on
What Will We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You don't have to chat with Carter Wolf long to discover that he's a fellow who believes in a well-rounded education. Carter has a new job that will put that philosophy to terrific use. He's the new executive director of the Indianapolis Arts Center. Sharon Gamble invited him in to learn a bit about this Renaissance man.
Your life has had several different paths that seem to be converging in your new role. Did you, when you were, say, a kid, did you ever think that this would be where you'd be? Now?
Good grief. I don't think I thought that far ahead as a kid, but I think like a lot of people, and particularly maybe in the baby boomer generations, you know, you develop lots of interests. And I think part of that was, you know, the schools were great, and we had more offerings probably than they're able to have today. You know, several people would stimulate you when you're younger and in and out of school. But I was always excited about several things. You know, nature was always an issue, the arts, history, particularly ancient history, which doesn't take too big a segment to move into the arts from there.
No, not at all.
And I think that's you can't go to Rome too many times without falling in love with everything about Rome. So I think that was natural. I actually was going to be an architect, and the long line of math courses moved
so
me over
to fine
arts. Get
out of my
head.
I was just thinking math, so much math.
All right. And then in back then, too, I think there was a lot of social engagement with issues, and I think I got very interested and still with issues of social justice and civil rights and all those pieces that kind of came together for not just me, but I think a lot of people in the generation. And we can throw rock music in there, too. So, I mean, it's a multifaceted. My parents were educated in a very liberal arts kind of play. They both went to Oberlin College, and we had, you know, certainly a lot of classical music and pieces around.
School.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And a lot of art books, which I would love going through. But
did your parents encourage you in the arts, or was it just there and it was expected to be part of your life?
The encouragement was education in all forms, and so the piece about being hungry for knowledge was very much a part of our whole family, and you know, everything from every time we go on a vacation, we'd drive across the country and we'd stop at all the historical markers and we'd stop at museums, and it was always those kind of trips. And but when I in college, I think that was where I really got excited after from liking the art to really getting excited about art, and I think I left kicking and screaming because it became one of those 24-hour things. So I taught junior high art for several years in a time when in a school that was tough and very rewarding, but they would, you know, lay on the numbers. I had 360 kids a week.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
how do you give kids individual attention with that many?
How do you learn their names? You can't teach kids without learning their names,
right.
And I think that was the first months were always a challenge, but I really tried to get kids away from focusing on who's the good artist and who isn't the artist. That there was something in this that everybody could come away from, and everybody could learn from, because we weren't going to create 360 artists out of that group. But learning creative ways of solving problems and learning things that you can get excited about, whether your skill level was as high as someone else, really didn't matter. So, you know, I get good response from that. And I surprisingly had quite a few kids come back and said they majored in art and later. And that kind of surprised me, but I was very, you know, rewarding.
It seems like you've just described in some ways the philosophy of the Indianapolis Art Center. You're bringing the love of the art and the craft of metalworking, jewelry making, lamp working, sculpture, painting, to people who may or may not be professionals, who may not want or need to be professionals. We live in a time when the word amateur has a bad reputation, and it troubles me a little bit.
Well, you know, it's not necessarily whether you're a professional or an amateur. I think it's whether or not something excites you and turns your hair on fire, and as I like to say it. And it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter if you can get engaged in the process. I think that's important. Certainly in a school like ours, we always want to push people to get more involved so that they learn to be better at what they do, particularly
right.
If they're there year after year and really want to grow, and much like a university setting, you really want to push everybody's boundaries.
Is there a core group of students who come back to you again and again?
Oh, there are. There's some students who take the same discipline year after year, so they're just do painting. And for a lot of reasons. One is they feel like they are challenged every semester to constantly do better. Some like the discipline of having a class. You know, like, it's the way I exercise. I need to have my running group or I wouldn't show up.
Right, right.
And then I think some people also like the community of being with other people who are maybe totally different from them, but in the classroom, everybody's there in a similar kind of reason and purpose and can get excited off each other. I think one of the best experiences for me in art school was learning from everybody else. You know, it wasn't just the professors. It was bouncing off each other and critiquing each other's work on a Saturday afternoon. And so it wasn't just take a class, you know, do your homework and come back and do your final. So it was a very different environment. They would even let us lock ourselves in the art building at night, and I just loved
really?
That. Of course, we'd always sneak in a little wine or something, but it was a...
He went to Ball State, by the way.
Oh, yes.
If any Ball State professors are listening.
I don't know if they'll lock the students in overnight anymore, probably for other reasons. But
they said silly insurance liability stuff. But
it was fun.
But, yeah, and it's not about... meeting specific goals or a particular outcome—it's about the process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not to say that taking classes doesn't make you better and doesn't improve your technique and the craftsmanship. It certainly does.
Well, it's like Saturday afternoon. I went to work Saturday to do some catch-up work and ended up spending 6 hours doing a lot more. I was the sculpture studio had a pour, bronze pour, and
cool.
It was a real community of people, and Bernie and Glenn brought their classes in, and it was an all-day process of all the students there being involved in. They didn't watch. They were there to participate and the pouring of the metals. And then in the end, even no matter how good their work was, no matter how much knowledge they had about creating their molds, there's still a surprise. You know, you break open that mold and it's not always as you thought. So there was a lot of community excitement around that and the mystery.
You know, you mentioned being inspired by nature earlier. You certainly have a beautiful campus to explore that personally and also to, you know, help be the steward of for the community. What is the size? How many acres do you
have
there?
Well, that's a tough question. I got to go back and do my homework on
this. Oh, I'm sorry. I am putting you on the spot. You haven't been on the job for even a month yet as we're
My data bank is a little small. I'm
you
still dumping
forgiven.
My old data bank.
Yeah.
The Art Center is blessed by being a great environment. I mean, and between the building and the river, and the building and the Monon Trail is the Arts Park. And the Arts Park is a connecting between the architecture and nature, some a little wilder than others, but it's also a great environment for public art. And we have wonderful pieces down there. Some are right now, the George Rickey Show is on,
and
you can see the pieces outside and the wind moving just like downtown. But you can also go inside in the gallery, and there is a more in-depth study of some of his history and smaller pieces
and the
educational side.
The
That's right.
Too.
The maquettes are in there, and there's some of them are just scraps of wood he put together. So, you know, it's fun watching because you can see the artist process, you know, how he got from here to there and then grew over time. And I think great artists are all about growth. You know, they didn't find a moneymaker and then stick to it, though that is common. I think the great artists are artists who grew and changed. And
that's actually another role the Art Center fulfills in bringing in exhibitions from national, international artists, local, regional artists, and striking that nice balance and having the programming around it as well.
Well, the Rickey one is very connected because he was born in South Bend. There's an Indiana connection. It's a great piece for Indiana, a great show. But it's an exception because most of our shows are living, practicing artists. So you are seeing what people are doing now, and there isn't an end to it. It's still going on somewhere when you're watching the show. And I think the more you can learn about growth and process from how somebody got from here to there, and it's often a surprise, you know, that you know, you look at somebody and you see some of those George Rickey paintings in there, and they remind you of certain periods of Picasso's. They were very period-oriented. He was probably doing studies. He was probably practicing other styles.
There's one that looks like that if you didn't tell me it was George Rickey, I would say Thomas Hart Benton.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's just like,
sure.
Wow.
And he grew up during that time.
And you stand
sure,
in that
absolutely.
Room and you look around and you just think, this is so different from a show where everything is homogenous.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, the one reason I think Picasso, like a lot of people, is one of my favorites is because you watch his growth. You see all these periods, and they're connected. They're not disconnected. I think he said that when he was 13 years old, he could paint like Raphael, and he's been trying to learn how to paint like a child ever since. And that's a great artistic expression because he was trying to free his creative piece up that so many children lose as they get older, and we squeeze them into square boxes. And
so speaking of unlearning, I know you're not going to have a lot of time to do this, but it seems to be to me to be one of the fringe benefits of your job that you are on a campus where you can be hands-on. You can right. take classes and renew yourself.
Well, and I encourage everybody on the staff to take a class. I think that the learning, understanding the process, whether you came from an art background or you came from a financial background, you know, our finance director was in a class a Saturday and making things, and so he gives you a different perspective, especially as a student. I think that's very true. I think the temptation is I can easily get sucked out of the office into a class, where especially you walk by a glass blowing, you start watching, and you know you want to just get in. And so that's got good and bad. Sometimes you got to get your work done and back in the office where it's a little less exciting. But it's a great environment. The thing that impressed me, is besides the wonderful Michael Graves building, which is just a joy to work in and walk into every morning, you're also surrounded by all this, and it is college-level facilities.
Sharon Gamble with Carter Wolf, the new executive director of the Indianapolis Arts Center. Fall classes begin soon, and you can learn all about memberships to the Art Center, drop-in classes, the special event Art Sparkle, and more at, now, it's short for Indianapolis Art Center, but it's Indiblis, which is IndiplsArtCenter.org. Again, IndiplsArtCenter.org, or just Google Indianapolis Art Center. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra, from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 p.m.
I'll chat with artist Douglas David about his new work featuring urban landscapes.
I'll get a preview of this year's Start with Art Luncheon.
And I'll talk with the artistic director of the new Indianapolis City Ballet. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.